Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with best-selling novelist and blogger Cory Doctorow, whose new book is Homeland. And we'll talk with New Orleans favorite Christine Wiltz, whose post-Katrina caper is Shoot the Money. It's a great honor to talk with award-winning science fiction writer, blogger, technology activist Cory Doctorow. He's the author of such well-known works as Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, Makers, as well as many works of nonfiction. He edits the blog boingboing.net. Today, we'll be talking with him about his recent best-selling novel for young adults, Little Brother, and its newly published sequel, Homeland. Cory's on tour in Seattle today, but he'll be in New Orleans at Octavia Books February 20th at 6 p.m. Welcome to The Reading Life, Cory.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be on.
I love these characters in Little Brother and Homeland. And one of the things that makes Marcus Yallo and his friends work for me is that their characters are so strong and their lives are so intertwined and you become attached to them. So that frees you as a writer to discuss so many important issues. Set the scene of these novels for us, if you would.
Sure. Well, first, Little Brother is a novel about these kids who go to high school together and sneak out to play hooky to go play an alternate reality game, a kind of big treasure hunt. And while they're out doing this, something bad happens. The Bay Bridge gets blown up by parties unknown. And the Department of Homeland Security sweeps in, and they arrest people who are doing things weird and suspicious and inexplicable, and that covers all the bases for what these kids are doing. And one bad thing leads to another bad thing, and they're actually detained and treated very badly. When they get out, they discover that San Francisco has become a kind of police state. And they declare war on the DHS. They decide that it's time that someone brought the Bill of Rights back to America, and they use a cryptographically secured network of hacked Xboxes, and they do just that. And that was a fun book to write. And 5 years later, I wrote its sequel, which is Homeland. And Homeland is a book about a much more quiet and invisible kind of disaster. It's not the kind of disaster where everybody can point to a cause and describe what's going on. It's the kind of disaster where you wake up one morning and realize that all your neighbors have foreclosure notices up and that your parents have lost their jobs and that you can't afford to go to university anymore and your student debt is mounting. And Marcus, the main character from the first book, finds himself in possession of a whole load of leaks on a thumb drive, leaks that are about government corruption and corporate misdeeds. And he has to figure out how to get those out to the public in the midst of this disaster. And while this is going on, his own computer gets compromised by people who don't think he's leaking the leaks fast enough. And they start leaking his leaks for him. And he realizes the computer that he thought of as his tool of liberation can also be the ultimate tool to spy on him and control him. It's a very kind of taut, paranoid kind of book.
Well, one of the wonderful things you have in these books is the layers of technology, and you make them all comprehensible even to Luddites like me, so I'm very grateful. One of the fascinating things to me is that in Homeland, the characters are considerably more grown up, and this starts off at Burning Man, which I think is such an incredible scene.
Well, yeah, you know, I went to Burning Man for the first time a couple of years ago. Ironically, I never went when I lived in San Francisco. It wasn't until I moved to England that I started going to Burning Man. But as soon as I got to it, I realized that it was such an amazing thing that I needed to try and figure out how to turn it into a work of fiction, which is how I make sense of everything that's important to me, you know, sort of the fiction writer's disease. And I thought that it was a very good parable for some of the stuff that goes on in the book. And so the book starts and ends at Burning Man. And I hope I do it justice. Friends of mine who've been to the burn a lot more than I have tell me that I get close to what they think of it as. So,
well, that scene of the burning of the Library of Alexandria gave me chills, I have to tell you.
Well, that part I invented, but I've seen things, stunts that were every bit as cool. And I wasn't there, the year that someone brought a trebuchet and fired old unserviceable pianos into the desert. But I'm told that they did make the most amazing noise.
I can imagine that. I really can. So what reaction are you getting from young readers about these books? What do you hear from them?
Well, you know, Homeland has been out for exactly 12 hours.
Right.
The reaction's been a little slow coming, although I spoke to 600 middle schoolers this morning here in Seattle, and their school librarian just sent me their feedback, which is, you know, the miracle of modern age, and they were really effusive and generous in their feedback. But, Little Brother, I have gotten thousands and thousands of emails and letters from young people saying, you know, that it got them interested in technology, it turned them into computer programmers. A couple of people said that they went to law school because they read it, or have become career activists, or some combination of all of those things. And actually, one of the coolest letters I got was from Judge Alex Kaczynski, the senior judge of the Ninth Circuit, saying that it really made him rethink some of his approaches to privacy and computer literacy and surveillance.
Wow. Isn't it great to know you're having that kind of influence?
It really is. Boy, it's a bit scary.
Now, you're a very prolific and you're a very generous writer. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about some of your concerns. You're concerned with digital piracy. You're concerned with file management, all kinds of issues. And I particularly wonder if you'd talk a little bit about Creative Commons.
All of my novels and pretty much all my books, except for the very first one that I wrote a long time ago before Creative Commons was around, have been available as free downloads on the Internet right around the time that they were published under something called the Creative Commons license. Creative Commons licenses, you know, you've probably gone to get something from iTunes or to use some website. You've been confronted with all this legalese, you know, by having the audacity to want to give us your business. You agree that we're allowed to come over to your house and, you know, wear your underwear and punch your grandmother and clean out your fridge and make long distance calls. You know, all this stuff that just sort of takes away your right in the fine print. Creative Commons is fine print that gives you right. It's a way for a creator to tell his audience or her audience that they're free to do more than the basics with it. And so the Creative Commons licenses I've used have allowed people to go and make their own remixes, to share their works non-commercially, and to do lots of other things with them besides. And they've been really successful for me. And I use them for three reasons. And the first one is purely commercial, because I can't stop you from copying my works. I mean, it's the 21st century. It's never going to get harder to copy stuff. Every ebook is available with one click of the mouse if you don't want to pay for it. And so what I need to do is find a way to attract more business than I'm losing. I needed to find a way to bring new readers in and to recruit readers who love my book and get them to spread the word around. So long as more people who encounter a free download are enticed to buy the book as treated as a substitute, I'm ahead of the game. You know, I say I don't want to make sure that everybody who reads my book pays. I want to make sure that everybody who will pay reads my book. And so that commercial dimension is great, and it's worked out for me. I've had New York Times bestsellers and mid-six-figure advances and translations into dozens of languages and theatrical adaptations and film licenses and everything. But that's just the first part. The other two dimensions are moral and artistic. Artistic's really easy to understand because, like I say, the 21st century, copying isn't going to get harder. And so if you're making contemporary art, you really need to assume that it's going to be copied. Now, there's nothing wrong with not making contemporary art. If you want to be like the blacksmith at a pioneer village or, you know, reenact the Civil War or whatever, that's cool, but it's not contemporary art. And science fiction writers are supposed to be at least contemporary, if not futuristic. And then the last piece is this moral dimension, because increasingly we're seeing laws being passed around the world and at home that justify surveillance and control and censorship in the name of defending copyright. You'll remember last year there was a big fight about a law called SOPA and TIPA that allows for arbitrary censorship of the Internet. In the United Kingdom, where I live, they're saying that if you live in a house where someone is accused of using the network to infringe copyright three times without proof, that your whole family will lose its Internet access for a year. And what we've seen through studies is that Internet access is correlated with access to education, to nutrition, to political engagement and civic engagement. It's a huge raft of things that you cut off from people when you cut off their Internet. And so for me, allowing people to share my work and not being part of the rubric for these terrible, crushing, punitive copyright laws gives me real moral secure to know that I'm not doing art in a way that demands censorship is very important to me.
I think one of the great issues we face as a country is ensuring Internet access to everyone.
Oh, I agree. I mean, that's a multifaceted problem. It's not just about copyright, but about all kinds of policies, not least the fact that the telcos and the cable operators really game the legislative system. I mean, you look at a state like North Carolina, which has the Research Triangle, and you'd think would be a hub for high-speed internet. And instead, it's got some of the worst internet in the lower 48. And when they proposed legislation to allow cities to put together their own internet, high-speed internet, in places where the phone company and the cable operators wouldn't put in high-speed, the cities were going to do it, people were going to make co-ops to do it. And the cable operators, the phone companies, lobbied successfully in the state house to ban cities putting together high-speed internet access for the people who live there, even if the cable operators and the phone companies wouldn't provide it. Basically, if they won't do it, no one's allowed to do it. Oh. And that's terrible.
Yeah, I agree. Now, Homeland has some amazing afterwards, and one is from your friend, the late Aaron Swartz, one of the co-founders of Reddit, and my sympathies for that terrible loss, which is so recent. How was he involved with Homeland?
Well, you know, when I was writing Homeland, I knew that a lot of it was going to revolve around a next-generation, muckraking, independent political campaign from someone who wouldn't be beholden to corporate donors when he got elected. And I knew a bunch of people who were involved in campaign strategizing for both the Republican and the Democratic parties. And I wrote to them and I said, you know, tell me what you would do. What's your clean slate wish list? And none of it really helped. And then I wrote to Aaron. And Aaron, an hour later, fired back a fully developed program for building an independent political campaign that would run on people power, use the internet in ways that no one had ever thought of. And he ended it with, I should stop writing now because I've got to go build this. You know, I found out that one of the last things he committed code to before he died was a project that's clearly inspired by it. So, you know, he was really instrumental to writing the book. And then when it came time to get these afterwards for it, his little brother had a pair of afterwards in it, and I knew I wanted a pair of afterwards in Homeland. I wrote to Aaron and I said, could you write me a letter, an open letter to a kid like you, 13 or 14 today, but really clever, really on the ball, really gets computers and really wants to change the world, and tell them your best advice. And again, an hour later, Aaron fired back this amazing open letter to the young people of the world explaining the power of the internet and the promise of the internet and the peril of not getting it right. And the last line was, let me know if I can help. And he signed it with his email address. It was really tough, obviously, on all of Aaron's friends when he went. And you know, I've talked with his family a little about this tour, and one of the things that I'm doing when I go around and talk about the book and the issues that are in it is I'm also talking about depression and suicide and about taking care of each other. I mean, we in the technology world, we know an awful lot about what each other are doing. We've got our Foursquare check-ins and our status updates and our new code check-ins and so on, but we don't always know what each other are feeling. And so making sure that we're on the alert for friends who are in low places and that we're supportive with them and that we talk to them and that we make sure that they understand that it's okay to talk to us about this stuff. That's one of the things that I'm going around and talking to people about, too, on this tour.
And that's one of the wonderful things about the characters in the book is their care and concern and deep knowledge for one another. But at their heart, both these books are such calls to engagement, citizenship, all those incredible values. Oh, well, it's been so great to talk to you. We've been talking with the amazing Cory Doctorow, who will be signing Homeland at Octavia Books February 20th at 6 p.m. Thank you, Cory, so much.
Well, thank you very much. I can't wait to get to New Orleans.
Shake your money maker. Shake your money maker. Yeah, shake your money maker. Shake your money maker. Yeah, shake your money maker.
Christine Wiltz is the author of three mysteries featuring Irish Channel detective Neil Rafferty, Killing Circle, The Diamond Before You Die, and The Emerald Lizard. She's also the author of a novel, Glass House, and a biography, The Last Madam, A Life in the New Orleans Underworld. Shortly after Katrina, she began writing a new and very different kind of novel, a comic caper called Shoot the Money that's taken a long and different path to publication. It's a very funny, very unusual book, and she's here today to talk with us about it. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Susan.
You're no stranger to the reading life. Welcome back.
I love being here. Thanks for having me.
Now, you know I've read all your books at different times,
yes,
more than once, and Shoot the Money just cracks me up.
That is so gratifying to me that I hardly know what to tell you.
Well, it's characteristic of that dark, dark humor I think we all felt. Well, it's part of New Orleans humor anyway, don't you think?
Yes, very much so.
So tell us how the plot of Shoot the Money came to you.
Let me just start off by saying that this novel is something that I started after writing The Last Madam. I decided I needed to get back to novel writing lickety-split or I was going to become much too dependent on facts. So I started writing this book, and I wrote about 100 pages, and then I just got stumped. And I didn't quite know what I was trying to do with it. I had rewritten Karen and the opening with Karen, one of the protagonists, and Rainey, the other one, probably each of their chapters 30 times. So I just put it aside, and before I could ever get back to it, Katrina happened. Well, that all of a sudden made any book that wasn't post-Katrina, whether you were really going to write about Katrina or not, it just, if it wasn't post-Katrina, it wasn't right. The city was not that city anymore. So I had a problem. I needed to go back, but I didn't really want to write a Katrina book. So, but when I did get back to it, I just started from the beginning, and I started inserting a bit about Katrina here and there. I decided it would take place 9 months after Katrina.
And you've called these characters, these women, your trickster women.
They are tricksters. They're up to mischief. They don't even know they're up to mischief, and they're up to it. That's just the way they operate. I don't know. To me, there's something very New Orleans about that. There are a lot of tricksters around here. I mean, the way we love our masks and our parties and our contradictions and all the things that make us us. So, yes, they are tricksters. And the two of them coming together, these two women, one who is from Mamou and just decided that she did not want to be the wife of a rice farmer, and so she got out. And the other one, who's been living the high life in Miami, they come back to town and they hook up with yet a third woman who's older than both of them, named LaDonna Johnson, who owns La Costa Brava on Frenchman Street. Together, they're as good as the Three Musketeers any day.
Yes, they are. And a lot of this has to do with money. You've always written a lot about women and money.
Well, I think that women don't talk about money as much as they should, that they are sort of embarrassed about it. At one point in Shoot the Money, one of them says that they feel like if they're embarrassed, if they have too much of it, but then they're just as embarrassed if they have none. They don't know how to deal with it or how to talk about it, and most of them don't know how to make it.
One of the characters has a mother who has a money club, who's
right,
thinking about money all the time, which I love.
Yes, she said that, of course, her daughter, who is Karen, the main protagonist, says that her mother really is using all the same old New Age words. But instead of being about men now, they're about money. And her mother even admits that she's much more interested in money than men at this point in her life. And she starts this money club, which is actually being quite successful. And I just think all of this is so funny. This whole thing, you're talking about plot earlier, one of the things that gave me the idea for this book was an article I read in Cosmopolitan magazine about how emotional women are about money, how they all cry over it. And I thought that was one of the scenes I imagined, was this money club, and one of the women just starts to cry over the fact that she had no money, and now she's saved $1,000 in 6 months.
Well, you've written about women and sex and women and power in all of your books, whether directly or indirectly. I mean, probably most directly in The Last Madam. But this book is just like in your face. and hilarious, too, at the same time. These are women who aren't afraid to use sex and aren't afraid to use power. So how do they fit into the stream of women you've written about?
Well, they are very much direct descendants of Norma Wallace. I mean, you know, Norma supposedly had no kids. These can be her kids. They are very direct about it, too. They come at it. To them, this is nothing that you shouldn't talk about. And they actually have a conversation, Rainey and Karen do, when an older man who is reputed to be the richest and ugliest man in the city of New Orleans really wants to marry Rainey. And when Rainey decides that she's going to do this, Karen says, come on, just admit it. You're marrying him for his money. And she says, well, of course I am. And he knows that. And he's marrying me for my looks. So what's wrong?
And there are several X-rated passages we cannot refer to on the radio.
Oh,
that are quite amusing.
I have one all ready to read. I'm sorry.
You sure?
No. You're right. X-rated. Oh.
Now, the climate for publishing Katrina stories has been difficult, I think, and the path to publication of Shoot the Money has been unusual. For you, this is the first book that you've had go as an e-book first.
Yes, which was a very surprising thing to have happen. And this problem in the publishing world has been there since I started publishing. My first publisher was bought by a concrete conglomerate, Macmillan. If you can believe that. They're not owned by that concrete conglomerate any longer. But now we all know that the companies that publish out of New York especially have dwindled. And what was just too aggravating to me, and I don't know whether going through Katrina and all of that just gave me less patience somehow. You'd think it would have given you more. It was really aggravating to me that they were all taking such a long time. Your agent would submit a book, and you wouldn't hear anything back for 8-9 months. Some people were telling me it had been over a year. And I went through this umpteen times with an agent who refused to describe this book in the way in which I wanted him to. And I just upped and decided one day that maybe I would try this self-publishing thing that was going on. But my Hollywood agent, who optioned The Last Madam, stopped me from that. He said, no, I've got a company I want you to go with. And he put me together with these people who put the book out in ebook, and it's been an ebook for a year, and now it's coming out in print.
So it's,
which
it's
is
backwards.
Backwards, right. But we'll see. We'll see if that ebook garnered a following of sorts that will translate over, or if it's just going to be two entirely separate things.
It's going to be really interesting to see. And these are such odd times in publishing. I think most authors feel whatever they can do to get the books out there by any means necessary mode right now, don't you think?
I absolutely do think that. And I personally think a lot of people are not in favor of all this. They do not like ebooks and e-reading. But I think that what everybody needs to remember, this is not an either-or proposition. And you hear all this doomsday stuff, there are going to be no more bookstores, no more books. No, I do not believe that. Nothing that I read, and I read about this all the time, indicates to me that that's going to happen. All it is another choice. And where books are concerned, I think that is a plus.
Well, we'll have to hold on tight and see what happens.
Hold on tight because it isn't over yet.
Hold on to your books. That's what I think, you know. All right. We've been talking with Chris Wiltz, whose new book is Shoot the Money. You can meet her February 19th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop when she'll be talking with Ruta Sepetys about her book, Out of the Easy, which drew on Wiltz's biography of Norma Wallace. Thanks so much, Chris.
This was fun, Susan. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Ruta Sepetys signs Out of the Easy and discusses her work with today's guest, Christine Wiltz, whose new book is Shoot the Money. Tuesday, February 19th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Catherine Kratzer-Labor discusses and signs the story behind the painting about the Assumption of Mary painting at Xavier University. Tuesday, February 19th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Cory Doctorow, signs Homeland, Wednesday, February 20th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Meta Sama reads her poetry Wednesday, February 20th at 8 p.m. at the UNO Sandbar on Founders Road inside the Cove. Her most recent work is Nocturne Trio. Moira Krohn reads from The Not Yet, and Mark Statman reads from Black Tulips, his translations of the poems of Jose Maria Hinojosa, Thursday, February 21st at 7 at the University of New Orleans Fine Arts Gallery. Mark also appears Monday, February 25th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. John Werner signs Between Heaven and Earth, Thursday, February 21st at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Great Books Discussion Group discusses The Hours by Michael Cunningham, Thursday, February 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. As part of the Alvar Arts Series, Ken Foster discusses his book, I'm a Good Dog, Thursday, February 21st from 7 to 9 at Alvar Library. The new issue of Bayou Magazine, number 58, makes its debut Thursday, February 21st at 9:30 at the Always Lounge. Andre Kudrescu reads from A Recently Rent World, New and Selected Poems, 1968 to 2012. Thursday, February 21st at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon with Dave Brinks, whose new collection is The Secret Brain. That's part of the 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Kudrescu also appears Friday, February 22nd at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Cherise Coulter signs her book, Rock My World, and Lee Coulter signs his CD, Mr. Positivity, Friday, February 22nd from 6 to 8 at Garden District Bookshop. Maya Elgin, Melissa Dickey, and Nick DeDominic read in the Diane Tapes reading series, Friday, February 22nd at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in Bayou St. John. The Historic New Orleans Collection's 18th Annual Symposium will be held all day February 23rd at the Hotel Monteleone. This year's topic is Seeking the Unknown, Perspectives on Louisiana's Natural History. 10 scholars in the fields of science, art, history, and preservation will appear, including Robert A. Thomas, director of the Loyola University Center for Environmental Communication, Henry Bart, Tulane University Museum of Natural History, Prosanta Chakrabarty, Museum of Natural Science, Louisiana State University, Robbie Etheridge, the University of Mississippi, and Gay Gomez from McNeese State University. By admission. For information, check out hnoc.org/programs/symposia. Kim Voss signs The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition, Saturday, February 23rd from 4 to 6 at Community Book Center. The Poetry Brothel is holding a pop-up event at Crescent City Books, Saturday, February 23rd from 8 to 10 p.m. The Poetry Whores will be offering private readings in the stacks. There will be live music and an artist offering impromptu sketches. By admission. Judy Connor discusses and signs her book, Southern Fried Divorce, The After Party, Sunday, February 24th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the F&M Patio Bar, 4841 Chapatoulas. Louisiana author Carrie Dunn, author of the neo-noir thriller Joe Peace, performs and signs his book, Sunday, February 24th at 3 at the Fairgrinds Coffee House. The Fiction Writers Group meets Monday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Special guest is author Christy Soto. A Studio in the Woods presents a joint poetry reading by Melissa Dickey and Benjamin Morris, Monday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at Cudd Hall at Tulane University. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.